21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. She's a burrito, walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change. And I get the strangest feeling as I'm heading for the light.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, our executive producer and research assistant, Loa Dankner. Nope, I'm sorry. It's Laura Kortner. And our board operator, our engineer tonight is, of course, Noah Dankner. How could multiple ancient cultures, spanning both the years, or both years and geography, have strikingly similar creation myths and cosmologies? Why do the Dogon of Africa and the civilizations of ancient Egypt, India, Tibet, and China share sacred words and symbols, revealing the existence of a long-forgotten primal culture in the world's first center of higher learning? Laird Scranton shows how the sophisticated complex at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey is the definitive point of origin from which all the great civilizations of the past inherited their cosmology, esoteric teachings, and civilizing skills such as agriculture, metallurgy, and stone masonry. Laird Scranton is a recognized authority on Dogon mythology and symbolism. He's a frequent radio guest on, Red Ice Radio, Coast to Coast, and he has been featured speaker at the national conferences on ancient mysteries, including the Paradigm Symposium. He's the author of several books, including The Science of the Dogon and China's Cosmological Prehistory. He lives in Albany, New York. Also, tonight we're going to be talking about Point of Origin, Göbekli Tepe, and the spiritual matrix for the world's cosmologies by Laird Scranton. Well, that'll teach me on getting 4 hours sleep a night, doesn't it? Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Laird.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bob. It's my pleasure to be back. I always enjoy our discussions.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I have a question, though.
Okay.
How many times have you joined us?
I think this is the third.
I think it's, third or the fourth. Well, why haven't you ever mentioned that on the back of your books?
I should, okay? I'm the next one. Actually, I don't really have artistic control of what goes on the back of the books, but I'll suggest it.
We'll suggest it to them because they're my publisher as well. I think we better wake them up here, huh? Yeah, okay. Well, what is it about the Göbekli Tepe site in Turkey that makes it of unique interest to researchers?
Well, for people who aren't familiar with what Göbekli Tepe is, in the 1990s, a Turkish farmer, was trying to plow a field and hit a block of stone and discovered that it was the top of a megalithic pillar. It was a carved pillar. And since that time, there have been ongoing excavations at the site, and archaeologists have determined definitively that this site is an exceedingly ancient site. It dates from about 10,000 BC, which is very, very early. Around the time that it dates from, humanity is expected to have been hunter-gatherers. There shouldn't have been anybody who had technology to create these carved stone pillars and move them around and put them in stone circles and things like that. So there's this mountaintop sanctuary that in southeastern Turkey called Göbekli Tepe, and it's a mystery because no one knows for sure how it connects, but the symbolic elements that are there seem pretty familiar in relation to much later ancient religions.
I was just wondering how long this might take to get into traditional history or history books in regards especially to those in high school and colleges. How long do you think it's going to take? Because we have such cultural lag, especially in this country, things being discovered decades and substantiated, and it just takes a long time to have them reported. What would be your guess as to how long it's going to take for them to open up to this?
Well, Göbekli Tepe has gotten a lot of attention because it is so early. It's much earlier than traditional researchers had thought they would find anything like this. Mm-hmm. And also because it comes from the region of the Fertile Crescent there, where a lot of other interesting things happened around the same time. Mm-hmm. It's the spot where we find the first evidence of cultivated wheat. It's the first time we find evidence of domesticated animals like sheep and cows and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the region in which we find the first evidence of metallurgy, metalworking. And now here is evidence of stoneworking that is so old that they don't even have a historical trail of the tools that would have been required to build it. They don't have a line of evidence that shows the evolution of the tools, that the carving tools that would have been used to carve the stones. So it's a pretty old site, and hard to explain where it came from, and hard to explain how it links forward to other cultures. And so part of my my purpose in writing this book was I could see that the various structural and symbolic elements that exist at Göbekli Tepe seem remarkably familiar, considering that there's a 7,000-year gap between the time frame of Göbekli Tepe and later cultures like ancient Egypt or the Vedic tradition in India or traditions in ancient China, places like that. What we have at Göbekli Tepe is what looks like a mountaintop sanctuary. It's a series of stone circles, basically, that are made up of large megalithic pillars that may weigh multiple tons, smaller walls that were made from stone, and seating places that were made from stone, and beautiful images, carved images on the pillars of all sorts of different types of animals, and of some symbols that we don't know, we're not certain what they mean. And it was all preserved into modern times because about 1,000 years after it was built, it was deliberately buried. Nobody knows why. Very carefully and deliberately buried in a way that wouldn't damage the carvings.
Well, that's very interesting because obviously they wanted it preserved.
Somebody wanted it preserved. No one is sure why they would have gone to the amount of work that it would take to bury it. If you think of in modern Greek times, think of the Greeks choosing to bury the Parthenon, mm-hmm. or think about a modern group of Catholics in the 1950s deciding to bury their church. It'd be an immense amount of effort, and they would have to have a pretty good motive to want to do it.
Well, it would be really, you know, it's just in certain ways, it's just too bad that they didn't bury the Parthenon because it would be in much better shape than it is today. Not that I would prefer that they did, but I mean, it has a real function then because there are various fundamentalist types that are alive and well in Iraq today, whether they are from Iraq or not, that's something else, but that are destroying all the temples, tearing them apart, beating them in such a way that and in years to come, we won't be able to take a look at those particular areas. It's a good thing we have some photographs of them, right?
Yes, it's lucky that, especially in this case, that a very good job of documenting it and researching it has been done.
Yeah, because you...
And these are not... You would expect, since these are the first evidence we have of stone carvings like this, that they would be very simplistic. You know, these would be the beginning tries at stonework. But that's not really the case. It's really beautiful carvings.
Yes.
Some of it is in low relief, and some of it is in very high relief. But it's pretty easy to make out exactly what animal they were trying to depict. They did a very good job, whoever it was. Had clearly arrived at some skills in stoneworking, and we don't have a historical framework to place that in.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's you know. What about, you touched on tools before. Do we have any idea as to what they could have used to do this? Or
no, we don't.
Them?
And theoretically, they shouldn't have had metal tools to be able to do it. And interestingly, the archaeologists have not come across in their digs any of the tools that were used to build it.
Mm-hmm.
This is true in other cases historically where we have stonework being done. There are are places in ancient Egypt where, you know, stone quarries where lots and lots of major stonework was done, but no evidence of the tools that they used to accomplish it.
That's amazing. That is amazing. It just reminds me so much of the various secret societies and initiates working towards something, which because they had to protect themselves. And, you know, if they hadn't protected in the Dead Sea Scrolls and put them in caves, we wouldn't have them. They would have been destroyed by various types of fundamentalists, especially they're hated today. They're not even discussed. And the same thing with other particular areas. Now, you noted that, well, what might you think the purpose of the Göbekli Tepe site have been?
That's an interesting question, and trying to get at that is presents some interesting difficulties because of the age of the site. If we go, most of the work that I had done prior to this book focused on the era of around 3000 BC, which is when writing first appears in most cultures. And anytime you have written texts, you also have clear statements on the part of the people who made those texts as to what some of their motives were and how they viewed some of their own symbols and how they looked at things. But there's a 7,000-year gap here back to Göbekli Tepe where we don't have written texts to be able to anchor interpretations with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a field like mine, which is called comparative cosmology, it really doesn't work to try to put forward a theory that's based on interpretations that only rests on what I've made up or what I surmise to be true. You need to try to find ways of anchoring it in things that are outside of yourself. And so one of the keys to being able to do that is language itself. Even though there wasn't writing, there was language. And the farther back in time we go, the more commonality of language, commonality of terms, commonality of words you find. So in the case of Göbekli Tepe, one of the obvious resemblances to someone like me is I know that at 3000 BC, the ancient Egyptians paid a lot of respect to a mythological era they called Zep Tepe. And it occurred to me that the Tepe in Zep Tepe, which Zep Tepe means first time, the Tepe in Zep Tepe might be connected to the Tepe in Göbekli Tepe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the question was, how do you demonstrate that? Well, several years ago, two friends of mine, an Egyptologist named John Anthony West, who studied the Sphinx, and a geologist he's worked with also studying the Sphinx, a Boston University geologist by the name of Robert Schock, were planning a trip to Göbekli Tepe and had invited my wife and I to a party at John Anthony West's house the night before they left town. And so I did some quick research. I didn't know very much about Göbekli Tepe, but I was interested in the animals that were carved on the pillars.
Mm-hmm.
Because the creation traditions that I study, there's a lot of symbolism associated with animals when they're trying to represent certain concepts of creation, like the concept of vibration is associated with the twitching of a rabbit.
Oh, yes.
So there are, you know, physical features and physical attributes that various animals had that associate them with these concepts of creation. And so my first instinct was that these animals carved on the pillars at Göbekli Tepe were probably cosmological symbols. The problem was there were certain animals there that I didn't know, based on my studies, they didn't seem to have any connection to cosmology, and I wondered about those animals. I could see some of the animals did, but other animals didn't. So realizing that there is commonality of language as we go back in time, the way I could demonstrate that in terms of Göbekli Tepe is in the ancient Turkish language, there are probably 25 different meanings for the word tepe. If we go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic language from 3000 BC or 2000 BC, we can discover at least a dozen of those same meanings tied to words that are pronounced tep or tepe. And so we can use that to demonstrate that when the ancient Turks said tepe, they probably meant the same thing that the ancient Egyptians meant with the term.
Well,
so I started examining these animals, the names of the animals that the Egyptians give them, and discovered that each of the names for these animals were pronounced like a term of cosmology, a term of ancient creation. Mm-hmm. And so even the animals that I didn't think were connected, the name of the animal was a homonym for a term of cosmology.
That's fascinating. That is. That is really fascinating when you get into that. But we need to take our first break. But when we come back, there is something that I truly enjoy about the way you do research. And if you don't mind, I'd like to point that out. And if you know where what I want to say, you just turn to page 2 in your introduction. Go down to the bottom paragraph there, Laird, and because I would like to read that, or you could read that, because what you say there is so significant that most other researchers and all these other esoteric areas should pay attention to. And that's the reason why we have you on 21st Century Radio, because you don't make that kind of mistake that so many other researchers have made in the past. So it's all your fault, okay? We'll be back with our guest, Laird Scranton, Point of Origin, Göbekli Tepe, and The Spiritual Matrix for the World's Cosmologies, published by Inner Traditions. Go to Laird, L-A-I-R-D, Scranton, at lairdscranton.com. Also linked on the front page at 21stcenturyradio.com, and we'll soon be adding this interview to our youtube.com/21stcenturyradio channel.
Hello, this is Dr. Robert Schock, author of Voices of the Rocks, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus, one of the most fascinating shows on the air.
Well, of course, you're listening to Telesma now. Good friends of ours. I've enjoyed listening to them for quite some time, and you heard Dr. Robert Schock. Dr. Robert Schock in 1992, when no one else would have him talk about what he was discovering, broke the story on 21st Century Radio that the Sphinx indeed was much older than we had supposed. And thank heavens, I'm so glad that happened, because it gets frustrating when you're ahead of your time. And unfortunately, many of the talk show hosts at that time just were—I don't know what to say about that. They just couldn't handle it for one way, or one reason or another. And now, our guest, of course, is Laird Scranton, and I think he can handle just about anything. The book is "Point of Origin: Göbekli Tepe and the Spiritual Matrix for the World's Cosmologies." Inner Traditions publisher, LairdScranton.com. Now, are you ready for this big quiz, Laird?
Sure.
All right. The bottom of page 2, an introduction. When I was reading your book, this thrilled me so much to see this in print. So I'm hoping that other researchers who like to use the internet but don't do any more than checking somebody else's work should pay attention to. And that is, Maza, would you like to read it?
Sure, I will.
Go right ahead.
First, you have to assure me that there won't be any math.
Math?
Yes, I'm happy to read, but I'm not going to do math.
Okay, you don't have to read it. No, you don't have to.
No, I'm happy to read it. The paragraph says, any researcher of ancient mystery traditions relies on interpreted meanings to arrive at an understanding of the material he or she studies. Unfortunately, the human psyche is arguably wired to infer patterns and meanings in otherwise confused world, sometimes even in situations where those meanings may not actually pertain. For instance, what young child has not looked up into the sky and marveled at images he or she perceived in random cloud shapes? In my experience, one of the great professional dangers to those who study ancient traditions lies somewhere in the dark recesses of their own subconscious willfulness. The danger can take the form of subtle predispositions that lead us to perceive a pattern where none actually exists, or to draw inferences that are objectively unwarranted. In order to guard against my own wishful tendencies, I have tried to adopt a professional standard that, whenever possible, each interpretation should begin with an overt statement on the part of the culture being studied, and this statement should either be overtly confirmed by references from other similar cultures, or else be clearly restated in more than one way within the first culture.
Well, you know, today, especially on the internet, and in the particular field that I am in history, fundamentalists have done just that. They have speculated and distorted history to such an extent that today tens of thousands, millions of people are believing in research about various conspiracies that truly don't exist, but make one hell of a lot of money for fundamentalists as they sell their books and DVDs. That's true.
It is true.
And, you know, I've watched this for, we've been on the air for almost, well, we're heading towards 30 years, and it was just the same back there in the 70s and 80s, but it's so much worse now. But I think the quality of your research is going to stand the test of time, Laird, because of the methods by which you check, recheck, and go beyond that to substantiate what you believe to be true. So that's...
I really appreciate you saying that. I hope you're right.
Well, I am right. I'm never wrong.
My wife says Risa says she thought she was wrong once, but she was mistaken.
Yes. That's great. Yes, that's like people, politicians especially, do that number right often. Now, symbolic elements. You mentioned some symbolic elements in the animals and things of that nature. But what kinds of other symbolic elements do we find at Göbekli Tepe?
Well, we have a number of interesting things. If we were to express it as a group of elements that belong together as a set, it consists of megalithic standing stones, pillars that are placed in a circle, stone pillars, images of carved animals. On the sides of some of the pillars, on at least one of the pillars, there is a pair of carved arms and hands that sort of emerge out of the side of the stone and run down the edge of the stone, and the hands wrap around the end of the pillar. There are carvings of what look like three little hand baskets with a handle, that nobody knows what those are. There are a number of instances where there's a carved figure that looks like the letter H. There are symbols that look like a carved belt that lead researchers to believe that these pillars were meant to represent ancestors. These were attempts at anthropomorphizing, you know, turning a piece of stone into essentially an early statue of a person.
Mm-hmm. What about any symbols that represent words?
That's a good question. My outlook based on the animal names was that the animal pictures might have represented a kind of proto-writing. The idea being that a hunter-gatherer who didn't know how to read or write but knew the names of all the animals would walk up to a pillar, see the image of the animal, speak the name that he knew, and at the same time be speaking the term of cosmology that he was going to be instructed in at that site.
Mm-hmm. Are there any ancient written texts that tell us about Göbekli Tepe?
Not directly, but there are Egyptian references that are key to my being able to trace what we find there forward to other cultures. There are archaic written words in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language. Some of them are names of localities, geographic locales. And one of the questions I asked myself as I was studying this was, what did the Egyptians refer to this region of southeastern Turkey as? What word did they use to represent it? Now, there's a Greek term called Cappadocia, but the Egyptian term is given in Sir Wallace Budge's Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary as Get Pet Kai, which, if you understand how language works and realize that we're talking about a 7,000-year span of time between what Get Pet Kai might represent and, actually longer than that, a 12,000-year span range between what Get Pet Kai might represent and Göbekli Tepe, phonetically, it's pretty similar. It's possible that Get Pet Kai survived as Göbekli in Turkey.
Hmm.
we have clues because of these multiple meanings of the term Göbekli Tepe, of the words Göbekli and Tepe in Turkish language. One of the traditional translations for the name Göbekli Tepe is Potbelly Hill.
Oh, I like that one. Potbelly Hill.
It could also mean hill with a navel, which is a symbolic description of a Buddhist stupa. Because you have multiple meanings for these words, it's possible to put together many different potential interpretations of what the word means. Mm-hmm. But the term Potbelly Hill actually connects to the set of symbols that I am trying to carry forward and match on a go-forward basis to try to link this up with the other cultures. The problem was I had no idea which culture to try to link it through. My suspicion was that because we have pictures of scorpions and we have pictures of serpents and we have pictures of bulls, animals that were closely associated with kings and deities. We have pictures of vultures that were associated with mother goddesses in later times, that the chances are that there was symbolism here that was going to connect somehow. Mm-hmm. So working from this word Getpetkai, it's an archaic Egyptian form. It doesn't work the same way as the Egyptian words I normally work with. To give you an example, imagine if in the English language, after we wrote the word month, we drew a little picture of a calendar at the end of the word. Some Egyptian words work that way. They have what's called a determinative at the end of the word, a picture that seems to relate to the meaning of the word. Hmm. Well, in these archaic words, sometimes you have those determinatives on the front of the word as well as the back of the word, which is unusual. And in the terms of the word Getpetkai, we have a little picture of a shrine in front of the word, and we have a little picture of mountains on the end of the word. And so it looked to me as if this was meant to represent a mountaintop sanctuary, which mm-hmm. is what Göbekli Tepe is.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Now, in ancient Egypt, there's a famous temple site called Het Ka Pet. It's a temple in Memphis that the Greek term for Egypt, the word Egypt, actually ended up coming out of. And so I could, because of the way the complex phonetics work, sometimes G's are pronounced like H's. There are certain letters in Hebrew where under some circumstances it's pronounced one way, and under circumstances it's pronounced another way. There are at least four of those in Hebrew, and the same situation exists between other cultures, where a word that's pronounced one way in one culture is pronounced a different way in the other, but it's the same word. So the archaic pronunciation get ties to a more recent Egyptian term, pronunciation, het, and het means temple, or means house or temple. And so I could see that Het Ka Pet was a correlate to Get Pet Kai. So that was a clue for me. Mm-hmm. From there, I looked at a couple of other Egyptian words that were formulated the same way and looked like archaic temple or sanctuary names. And one of those is pronounced Ga-Nu-Sa-Ast. And Ga-Nu-Sa is similar to the word Ganesha in India,
Oh, yes. The
same way that Getpetkai is similar to Göbekli in Turkey. So I surmise there might be a connection to Ganesha somewhere there.
Well, this could suggest that the ancient Egyptians might have known about Göbekli Tepe. Could it suggest that?
It does, yes. If we can connect the word Getpetkai to Göbekli, then absolutely they must have known about it, and it seems very likely that there would be a connection between their first time Zeptepe and Göbekli Tepe. Mm-hmm. But trying to connect the dots between those two spots is very difficult to do, and that's what Point of Origin book attempts to do. It tries to present a rationale for how do you get from 10,000 B.C. forward to 3,000 B.C. To these other cultures in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, of course, especially if there are no written texts or records to go by, how could we hope to positively link a tradition from 10,000 B.C. forward to about 3,000 B.C.?
Well, so the key to doing it lay with the second sanctuary name that was pronounced Ga-Nu-Sa-Ast. Now, the first name, Get-Pet-Kai, could be modernized to Het-Pet-Kai-Ya. The second name, Ga-Nu-Sa-Ast, when I modernized the pronunciation of that, what it produced was Het-Penu-Sa-Ast. Now, I know Ast is a name for Isis or the star Sirius. And I know that Sa is a name for Orion, but I don't know what Penu is a name for. But there's a third astronomic body called Barnard's Loop that associates with those other two. It's a pretty likely guess that Penu would represent Barnard's Loop. The other problem was, I also know that Ast was a goddess in Egypt, that's Isis, and Sa was a god in Egypt that related to Orion, to Osiris and Orion. But I didn't know of a god in Egypt or in any culture whose name was Penu. So I started focusing on Penu as a possible key. I discovered there was a very ancient Egyptian god named Penu, or named Pen, who was a shrew mouse god. The word Penu means mouse or shrew mouse. And
shrew mouse.
That shrew mouse god was celebrated at a temple in, actually a couple of temples in Egypt at about the same time as the temple that I said the name of Egypt was based on. So we had parallelism there. We have a second sanctuary name that ties again to temples in that were in the land of Egypt whose names connect. So Penu looked like a key. Eventually what Penu led me to was an archaic cult in India called the Shakti cult. And in the Shakti cult, there are two mother goddesses. One was named the Harni Penu, and the other was named Tana Penu. And these two goddesses were understood to be the mother of Ganesha, the same, you know, the elephant god who I surmised that Ga-Nu-Sa probably related to. So now I've got links forward on, you know, two or three different connections to that cult through this one set of words.
Well,
moreover, one of the early symbols of these mother goddesses was a clay pot that was filled with water that represented a womb that was called a pot belly. Mm-hmm. Now, so I've got pot bellies associated with the cult, and I've got the name Pot Belly Hill as a translation of Göbekli Tepe. So now I've got another link to that same cult.
Well, that's how you build your case, and we'll continue on with this after we take this very, very important break with our guest, Laird Scranton, Point of Origin, Göbekli Tepe, and The Spiritual Matrix for the World's Cosmologies, Inner Traditions Publishers, LairdScranton.com, also linked on the front page at 21stCenturyRadio.com, and we'll soon be adding this interview to our YouTube.com/21stCenturyRadio channel.
Hi, I'm Michael A. Cremo. I'm author of the book Forbidden Archaeology, and I'm very happy to be on 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. It is a fascinating show, intellectually groundbreaking, presenting alternative points of view on all areas of science and popular culture.
Well, thank you, Michael Cremo. Boy, this man has really changed a great deal in our thought about how far history goes back. And boy, again, once again, he had to truly fight for that position. And that's one of the great reasons why I admire him so much. It's very easy in the media to get beat down by individuals who usually don't know what they're talking about. And we all face that problem when we do types of kind of shows that we do. Now, historically and geographically, how do you think the tradition we see reflected at Göbekli Tepe transmit itself into ancient Egypt?
Well, the way the language was suggesting that it passes through the Shakti cult. The Shakti cult, based on the sources I have who understand it best, One source says that it dates from time immemorial, he said, in India. It arose to the north and west of India, which is the direction that the Fertile Crescent and the Göbekli Tepe region of Turkey is located in relation to India. It's understood to be ancestral to the Vedic tradition, the Buddhist tradition, and the Hindu traditions, which are three traditions that I have explored and have found commonalities among. So the language was telling me, look at the Shakti cult. Now, I was also trying to match the set of symbols we found at Göbekli Tepe to a culture, and it turns out it's a great match for the Shakti cult. That the Shakti cult is characterized by, as I said, the potbelly clay pots, which connect to the name, but they were also characterized by standing stones and stone circles, the mountaintop sanctuaries. One of the things the Shakti cult did was they would take natural outcroppings of rock and turn them into carved sculptures. Mm-hmm. Now, if we talk to Dr. Robert Schock, the Sphinx in Egypt was originally carved from a natural outcropping of rock, so we have some commonality there. We also have some astronomical symbolism in Egypt that ties it to the same era of 10,000 BC that makes it look as if the structures in Egypt were either the alignments were set out in the era of 10,000 BC, or somebody after the fact somehow had the capability of retroactively calculating what the alignments should have been, because the alignments are right. They point to stars and astronomic bodies that as they should have appeared in 10,000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
So the Shakti cult looks like the one of the keys to this. So I...
Would you say that...
Settling as a source on a book called Shakti Cult of Orissa. Orissa is a region of India on the sort of the east coast of the peninsula of India, where that's the center of preservation of the Shakti cult tradition. And this cult has a number of things that are very interesting about it. From one perspective, the problem in India is that you have thousands of surrogates for any god or goddess who might exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, through the Shakti cult, originally the tradition was not iconic. They didn't make drawn images or carved images of gods or goddesses. They didn't anthropomorphize their concepts of creation the way that the Greeks did or the way the Egyptians did. They didn't have a deity they could point to as an image. But in later times, when it did become iconic, these two goddesses, Tanapenu and Dharnipenu, were always invariably pictured alongside Ganesha, which is one of the things that I was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
Their tradition passes through, is connected to the Turkish language and to the Tamil language. There are Tamil roots among the Dogon tribe that I study in Africa. A lot of the references that I find there tie back to the Tamil language, also tie back to Turkish. So there were lots of ways to tie things together linguistically. And there are also mythological connections to ancient Egypt. For example, in Egypt, the god Osiris, there's a famous myth about Osiris being tricked and then killed and dismembered, and his body parts spread all around Egypt. And then afterwards, depending on the myth you believe, either his wife Isis or his son Horus managed to pull all those parts back together and reconstitute him. Well, the same myth exists in the Shakti cult, only it's a mother goddess who dies and is dismembered, and her body parts fall to earth as thrones or standing stones that ended up being the sites of ritual centers all around India.
So
we can connect things to ancient Egypt through those mythic references. We can connect them through parallels of gods and goddesses. The mother goddesses, Tanapenu and Dharnipenu, have the same symbolism, same basic symbolism as Isis and her sister Nephthys in Egypt.
And would you like to say anything more about the two sisters there in regards to the star Sirius?
Yes, my anytime from a mythological standpoint that I hear a reference to two sister goddesses, my first guess is that they're talking about the two stars of Sirius.
Mm-hmm.
Sirius is the brightest star in the night sky. You can find it if you can locate Orion and the belt, the three stars that are the belt of Orion, and in your mind draw an imaginary line between those three stars. The line, follow the line down leftward and downward, and it brings you right to Sirius, which is a bright star you can't miss.
Mm-hmm.
But the Dogon know, even though the Dogon in Africa are a primitive modern-day tribe without technology, they know that this bright star in the sky is actually more than one star. It's at least two stars. It's a bright star and a dwarf star. They know the orbital period of the two stars, and they know the attributes of each of the stars and so forth. So the word Dharni means luminous, and so probably connects her, or could theoretically connect her, to the bright star of Sirius. And Tana, for Tana Penu, Tana, she's the earth mother goddess, and the phonetics Ta-Na, Ta means earth and Na means mother. So earth is a cosmological term for mass, and the second star in the Sirius system is a very massive dwarf star. So there's a symbolic, a possible symbolic connection there also.
So
a lot of the same symbolism applies to Isis in Egypt, who is connected to Sirius, and her dark sister Nephthys, who I associate with the second star.
So it does indeed seem to be some direct relationships between the deities in ancient India and those in ancient Egypt, and I'm not surprised by that. Especially about Ganesh and those. My very first spiritual teacher at Johns Hopkins University back in 1967-68 was from the family of the Ganeshi temple, and it was his job to take care of the elephants there, and that's why I'm so much interested in this, and why it played a major part in my life and growth and development. And your work has carried that on. Also, I'd like to emphasize this thing about clay pots, because pots were extremely important. Without them, carrying water around would have been a bit difficult. What other advantages are there to clay pots?
From the standpoint of the processes of creation, a clay pot represents, or from my perspective, represents a particle.
Mm-hmm.
From the standpoint of this archaic tradition, it represents a womb, and there are associations, symbolic associations between a particle of matter, if you talk about how matter forms, and an expanding womb, if you're talking about biological creation.
Mm-hmm.
And in these ancient traditions, there are three parallel themes of creation that all relate to a single set of symbols. We're talking about how the universe forms, how matter forms, and how biological reproduction happens. And so a clay pot can represent a womb, and it can represent a particle, and it can represent other things.
And that's one of the most important things, and also about any particular symbol having multiple levels of meaning and not just one. And that's one of the other serious problems fundamentalists have, because they only accept generally one meaning. And that's very unfortunate, because as esoteric traditions, as David Ovison has said on this show many times, there's a minimum of at least seven levels of interpretation of a symbol, and some of them go pretty deep and are hardly understandable by such lame brains as myself. So, but I have been told we have to cease and desist. But we will be returning to us next hour. And I think we're going to move on to, well, the question, if major religious traditions like Buddhism, Judaism, and ancient Egyptian religion all shared a common source, how did their gods, symbols, and rituals turn out to be so varied? Do you think you can handle that question, sir?
Sure, I can certainly take a stab at it.
All right, well, you can even cheat. We will allow you to cheat, okay? In other words, read your book. Which, oops, excuse me,
We'll be back with Larry Scranton in just a few minutes.
On Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Lucera, the National Security.